We have a really wonderful opportunity today because Robert Plowman is really has been a remarkably important figure in behavior genetics. Led it in amazingly productive, exciting directions, bringing an environment in which genetics, looking at how they interact together. It's really, I know Kathy McCartney, our dean, thinks, along with me, that Robert's been the most important figure in behavior genetics in the last 40 or 50 years. So it's especially exciting to have him come talk to us today. We've had a little trouble with the slides, but most of them are there and working okay. And he's here for our conference that starts tonight, and he agreed to come talk to you all, to us all, today in class. Please welcome him and be ready with your questions for discussion.
Thank you, Chris. Well, I'm very glad to be here and for the conference as well. I'm particularly keen on interdisciplinary setups because I really believe that's the future of science and that the big advances come from people who cross disciplines, and it's hard to do, and I'm going to make it harder because one of the things I want to talk about is genetics, which is subsumed a bit under the neuro part of what you do, the brain part, but it really is a thing unto itself, and I think probably next to neuro, one of the most exciting areas of science, of all of science these days. And it's kind of a missing link, I think, in brain, mind, and behavior. And so I want to give you a broad overview of what's new in genetics. I don't want to talk so much about just showing that genetic influence is important, because I think it is tremendously important for cognitive development, learning disabilities especially, which is one of the hottest areas now of neurogenetic research. And it's hardly mentioned in terms of education, but I predict that in the next few years, genetics is going to be the thing in terms of education. So it's very good, I think, for you to get an overview. As a result of that, and because we want to leave lots of time for discussion, I plan to give you a broad overview of sort of bottom lines of these new findings, rather than going into the data themselves or the methods by which we get there, because I can't do all of that in an hour. So that we have an hour afterwards, I think, for discussion. So if people are interested in more methodological issues, you know, we can certainly go into that. In addition, I think you've all had a couple of papers of mine, one more or less on molecular genetics and education, and the other from Merrill Palmer, which is kind of an overview of quantitative genetics and of some of the stuff I'm talking about today. And I think you have access to, but didn't actually receive, my paper for the conference, which I'm giving tomorrow. And this is basically the talk, although then we're only to give 10 minutes or so. And so what I'm going to do today is just go through it more slowly. But the point of that is, if I go through too much too fast, you could look at my talk, you know, which you can download, and then the talk has references to more of the data and the methods behind it.
Right, that's available on the conference website.
Okay. So I'll begin by not talking about this so much, but just about the basic idea of genetics in cognitive development, education. And it's puzzled me why educational psychology has been slow to accept genetics. You know, I did a survey of textbooks that, in England at least, which people get when they become trained as teachers. You know, there's next to nothing on genetics other than these rare, severe single gene disorders, which it doesn't have much to do with anything that you'll face in education. Some areas of psychology have really, I think most areas of psychology have gotten into genetics in a big way, and especially cognitive development and psychopathology, for example. So I do think education's next. I see that as the next big growth area for genetics. And so that's why I wanted to give you this overview today. But instead of just talking about genetics being important, which I believe it is, I'd like to emphasize what happens next. I mean, I do think in most areas now, it's no longer necessary to say genetics is important or to provide data for that. Most people accept that genetics is important. And what's interesting is to use these techniques to go beyond simply demonstrating the importance of nature, genetics. And I'll give you three examples of those, which I think have particularly important implications for the field of education. And those are the bumper stickers there that I'll mostly talk about. But the future of genetics is in molecular genetics. The research I'll talk about up until this last point is primarily what we call quantitative genetics, using indirect methods like twin studies and adoption studies to ask if there is genetic influence. But the excitement in science is about molecular genetics, using DNA to discover specific genes that are responsible for the widespread genetic influence, say, in learning disabilities. And that has a lot of implications for how we can proceed in terms of understanding these other issues as well. Okay, so the last part of my talk will be just to give you an overview of some of the issues involved in molecular genetics when you're studying complex traits, as we are in cognitive development or in education. That's my missing slide. I hope it's just one. Don't like that sound. Let me see if I... There we go. By quantitative genetics, I mean methods like the twin method and the adoption method that look at variants, individual differences in a population, and use these quasi-experimental designs to ask whether genetic differences or environmental differences are contributing to those observed differences. I do want to just take a moment here. I think the missing slide was this now that I think about it, to emphasize these different levels of analysis. Now, a lot of work that's done in cognitive development is what I call normative. If we ask, for example, why the human species is a natural language user, that's what I mean by a normative question, a between species sort of question. That's a very legitimate level of analysis. But what I'm talking about is a very different level of analysis that focuses on inter-individual differences within a species. That is, why are some children slow to pick up language? And is this on? Can you hear me okay with this? And why are some, I think when I get in front of this mic, I pick it up twice. Why are some children, why do they have reading disabilities when they get to school? Those are questions about individual differences. And I maintain for education and for society, these questions of individual differences are key. So I think it's a very important level of analysis, but the most important point is it's a different level of analysis. So language in the human species may be innate, and attachments, you know, in mammals may be innate at this normative level, but that has no bearing on understanding individual differences. So individual differences in language may have nothing to do with genetics. Attachment bonds may have nothing to do with genetics, which seems to be the case, by the way. So the most important point is that we eventually want to understand behavioral development at all levels of analysis, but what's important now is to make clear when you're talking about one level of analysis, like the normative level, or another level of analysis. And genetic techniques, like the twin method, only let us study individual differences. Now, if I was pushing an evolutionary sort of pitch here, what I could say is, well, these individual differences are kind of trivial. You know, a Martian comes down to Earth, and all us mammals look pretty much the same. What's the big deal here about one person being slightly different from another person? But in society, those are questions that are important to us, right? So I guess rather than arguing about which level's right, the main thing I want to say is these are perspectives, and like any perspectives, they're not right or wrong. They're just more or less useful for studying different questions. And you can't assume that under description or explanation at one level has any necessary bearing on description or explanation at another level. And then the main thing I want to make sure you understand is that what I'll be talking about today is an individual differences perspective, asking why some children differ from other children. And that's what genetics is about, my genetics. You know, we share 99.99% of all our DNA sequences. Now, that's a good argument for studying a normative approach. However, that 1 in 1,000 DNA base pairs that differ between us, at least at the 1% level, which is how it's defined, That's what causes all the genetic differences that I'll be talking about. So again, you know, you can argue for either perspective, but the important point to make here is that I'll be talking about that latter type of genetics. Inheritance, familial resemblance, why kids resemble their parents. Those are individual differences. You know, why is blue eye color or hair color inherited? Those are questions of individual differences. And we have the methods to address individual differences, both in quantitative genetics and molecular genetics. But it's extremely difficult to get beyond description at a normative level. So that could be a big topic for discussion if any of you are into evolutionary approaches. Okay, so the twin method then compares two types of twins. I'm sure you've all heard about it at some point, haven't you? And you know that about 1% of all births are twins. A third of those are identical twins or monozygotic, meaning one fertilized egg that splits in the first couple of weeks of life. And if it splits after implantation in the uterine wall, you can get into anastomosis where there's a shared circulation, or Siamese twins. So those are identical twins, and they're clones. When people worry about clones, identical twins are more clones than clones. If I clone me, my clone is reared in a different person at a different age, whereas identical twins are clones born in the same womb, raised in the same family, and going through life in the same cohort. So, and identical twins have no more known pathology than anyone else. So cloning is fine, at least in terms of identical twins. So we compare these clones to individuals who share 50% of their genes. And again, we're talking about differences, share 50% of their segregating genes, it's called. You and I share 99.99% of our whatever a gene is. See, nobody knows what a gene is. You're better off talking about, you know, DNA sequences, because gene is a word that means a lot of different things. And whenever that happens, that's when people get upset, because they're thinking about different things when they use these words. But fraternal twins and other first-degree relatives like parents and offspring, we say, share 50% of their genes. That's not right. But a coefficient of genetic relatedness is 50%. That is, of the DNA sequences that differ, we share 50% of those with our parents. They're called dizygotic because they're separately fertilized eggs. Okay, well, the twin method has been around for almost a century. The first study was actually done in 1924. And it's been used in many areas, like medical areas, to screen for genetic influence. Now, there are problems with the twin method, but the adoption method has different problems, and they converge on the same sorts of conclusions. And we can talk about the method if you'd like. But the reason I put this slide up is because in a science paper in 1994, I reviewed the major common medical disorders. Okay, these are ones that occur, say, generally above 1% in the population. And these, the green are the identical twins, MZ, monozygotic, yellow, dizygotic, fraternal twins. And what you can see if you compare the green to the yellow is that there are some disorders that don't show much genetic influence. The startling one for most people is this one, breast cancer, because all you hear about are the genes for breast cancer. But people don't understand, and the reason this approach is important is most of the reason why one woman gets breast cancer and the other doesn't is not genetic. Identical twin females are only about 15% concordant, meaning 85% of the time these clones, life term, are discordant for breast cancer. So that's an important aspect of the twin method. There is no genetic explanation for that in terms of the genetics I'm talking about, vertically transmitted segregating genes, right? I mean, most cancers involve DNA, but this definition of genetics is very restricted to resemblance, familial transmission. There's a lot of DNA that isn't genetic by that definition. And breast cancer is a big one. You know, almost all cancers involve DNA, but cancers show less genetic influence than just about anything else. And breast cancer shows very little. Now, there's been a huge study in Scandinavia of 50,000 pairs of twins that confirms these results more recently in the journal JAMA. So I think that's very important to know, that genetics has very little to do with breast cancer, with individual differences in breast cancer. Risk for breast cancer has not much to do with inheritance, okay? Now that is one we assume shows genetic influence, because all you do is, all you hear about is the genes for breast cancer. They were, you know, the three genes that have been found over the last decade or so, and that's a very big deal. And it might shed light on the processes involved in breast cancer. But it's important to recognize that most of the cause of individual differences in susceptibility to breast cancer is not genetic. And the identical twin discordance of 85% is the best evidence for that, because there's no genetic explanation for that. Now, we can talk later about, well, what about gene expression? Well, gene expression isn't genetic. Okay, so these are, you know, each of these things, I have to avoid going off on a long digression. But the point I want to make is that the twin method's useful for assessing rather than assuming what's heritable. Our assumptions about what's heritable has very little bearing on reality. Because you might say, ulcers, well, there's surely something that's environmental. Why should that be genetic? But it's one of the more heritable disorders. Because even if it is caused by stress, and that isn't completely clear, there's, for everything that's caused environmentally, like even susceptibility to viruses, shows a genetic component. It's, the agent isn't external and environmental, but the vulnerability is genetic. Okay, so the method is useful for assessing rather than assuming what's heritable. Oh, too bad. What's missing there is a similar slide that shows results for the common behavioral disorders. So we take, you know, disorders like alcoholism, schizophrenia, dementia, and the first thing we show is, again, why it's important to assess rather than assume how heritable disorders are. Because I bet, I've done this, you know, if we gave you a quiz and listed a bunch of medical disorders and behavioral disorders and asked which are more heritable, you would think the biological medical disorders would be more heritable. But what's the case is that the behavioral disorders are much more heritable on average than are the medical disorders. Nobody knows why that is. I think what might be involved is that behaviors farther downstream. The reason we think it's medical disorders are more heritable is they're upstream, closer to biology. And so you think, well, therefore they're more genetic. There's actually a very strong reductionistic tendency among biologists to think this is true. They talk about endophenotypes, things that are closer to the brain and further upstream are more heritable and simply heritable, you know, with a simple story. But in fact, I think, well, the data suggests it's the other way around. Behavior is more heritable. And I think it's because different biological systems with their genetic variabilities feed into something further downstream. But it's an interesting fact that behavioral disorders show more genetic influence. The other thing that's interesting is it's only in recent years that learning disabilities have been studied, and they are more heritable than any other behavioral disorder. So for schizophrenia, for example, for depression, their concordance is in the ballpark of 30%. By concordance, I mean if you had a if you were an identical twin and your co-twin was, what did I say, depressed, with major hospitalized depression, your risk wouldn't be, say, the base rate of 10% in the population, it'd be 30%. Okay, for schizophrenia, concordance for identical twins is 50%, as compared to a 1% base risk. So that's an astronomical risk, but 50% of the time, identical twins are discordant for schizophrenia. So when I talk to psychiatric groups, I'm the token environmentalist, because they've all got the message now, identical twin concordance, 50%, genetic influence, you know, and compared to fraternal twins and adoption studies. Well, that was the story 20 years ago. But now the story is concordance is only 50%. 50% of the time, identical twins, where one's schizophrenic, the other's not. And again, as we said for cancer, there's no way to explain that genetically. It's got to be environmental. Okay, so I think, 50% concordance for schizophrenia for identical twins, 30% for fraternal twins. But for learning disabilities, we're talking about 80% concordance. Most of that's on reading disability. And in recent years, the last 5 years, there have been several studies on language impairment. And that shows even stronger genetic influence than reading disability. And there's some work now, just in the last year or two, on mathematics disability. So learning disability, I think, is an area that's attracted a lot of geneticists, including molecular geneticists, and neuro people. And neuro people are going genetic. So I think those trends alone are enough to guarantee that the prediction's right, you know, that genetics is going to become increasingly important in research on learning disabilities. And I do feel that it's important for people in genetics not to resist that, but to recognize it's not all genetic. It doesn't mean teachers are out of a job because there's genetic influence. It's just helping us to understand the etiology of these disorders. And I just can't see any merit in sticking your head in the sand and pretending genetics isn't important when it is. Surely it must be better to go with it and to ask, where do we go from here? So I'll talk more about that a bit later. Anything more I wanted to say about this? Well, I could say anything now that I don't have the data, but I suppose. We're doing research on learning disabilities in a study I started 10 years ago when I went to England called the Twins Early Development Study. It involves, nice thing about Europe and Scandinavia, unlike the States, which is state-controlled, it's all kind of central in these countries in Europe. And so their birth records are central to the country. So we're studying all the twins born in England and Wales in 94, 95, and 96. And so here's one pair of identical twin girls. We enroll them in the first year of life. Then we study them using parent assessments of cognitive and language development. Did I say there are 55,000? Well, there are about 8,000 pairs of twins born a year. So in those three birth cohorts, there's 24,000 pairs, and we've been studying 15,000 pairs. So we're studying them using parental assessments like the MacArthur Communicative Development Inventory and a nonverbal measure that we developed at 2, 3, 4, and 7. I'll be talking about data from 7 years. At 4, we went into the homes of 800 families of kids who, on the basis of the parental screening, seemed to be delayed in either language or other aspects of cognitive development, and we administered several hours worth of tests to the children in their homes at 4. And then at 7, we use teacher as well as telephone testing instruments to assess this very large sample. So I could talk about why we use those measures, but maybe best to save that for later. And we find results similar to those found in other reports. This is the Tower test. And again, it's showing identical twin concordance of about 70-some percent and much slower fraternal twin concordance, about 45%, suggesting substantial genetic influence, even though we're just talking about 7 years of age, which is the second year of formal schooling in England. They start about a year earlier. And these are, you could say, teacher assessments, but I think they're actually better than tests. In England, there's a national curriculum, and these are the most tested kids in the world. And this score is the end of the year's summary score based on all the work they've done, including the tests they've taken. And so it also shows substantial genetic influence. Okay, well, I've always wondered how teachers and parents feel about genetics, because journalists, I think, believe that we're the bad guys taking naive parents who believe in the importance of the environment and, you know, flashing and saying, there's some genetics here, you know? And so I've wondered, you know, to what extent people think genetics is important. Because, you know, in the ivory tower, I know not everybody's convinced genetics is important, but I've always had the hunch that the man on the street is more sensible in some ways than some academics. And so this last year I did a survey of parents of young children and the teachers of those children and just asked them how important they think genetics is for these traits. Because no one's really done a survey of that sort before, despite my best attempts to get other people to do it, so I decided to do it myself. And what this shows is that over 90% of both parents and teachers believe that genetics is at least as important as environment. And I could give you more data on it. They don't think it's all genetic. They think these things are 40, 50 sort of percent. It really conforms quite well to the data as I see it. So I was, you know, pleasantly surprised by that, and especially by the teachers, because in England, as I said, they get next to no training in genetics. Yet you talk to seasoned teachers, and they all believe in genetics. You know, not that it's all genetic, and that's part of the problem. I think in the past, you know, is it genetic or environment? Is it nature or nurture? And, you know, what we know now is that both are important. And if both are important, then what you want to do is study them together. We need all the help we can get to understand the development of these complex traits. Okay, so that's the past. And what I want to focus on is the use of these quantitative genetic techniques to go beyond nature versus nurture. You know, it's nature and nurture. And one topic I've dubbed the nature of nurture. It's genetic influences on environmental measures is the operational definition. But more largely, it's the idea that children's genetic propensities are correlated with their experience. That children just, it's, you know, the stimulus response model is kind of dead, but it still exists out there in terms of the way we measure the environment. That genetic influences, I believe, have their biggest impact on how children experience their environments. It's the environments they select. Do they hang out with other musically gifted or athletically gifted kids? The modification of the environments that they're in, and really the creation of new environments. That is, if you've ever seen, you know, mathematically really gifted kids or musically gifted kids, you couldn't stop them, in a way, from using that propensity. I mean, they can hum inside their head even if you don't let them talk to other kids or listen to the radio. So in quantitative genetics, this concept is called genotype-environment correlation, and it literally means a correlation between genetic propensities and environmental experiences. And I'll talk to you about three types. Over the last 10, 15 years, there's been quite a bit of research on this topic in terms of the family environment. And in a nutshell, what this approach involves is treating environmental measures as dependent measures in quantitative genetic analyses. And when this was first done by my first student, David Rowe, who died last year, tragically, in 83, the first study was published, people thought this was nuts. You're taking a measure of the family environment, how adolescents perceive their parents' treatment of them, and you're doing a twin analysis, comparing identical and fraternal twin correlations on the environmental measure. It sounds nuts, doesn't it? Because the environment doesn't have DNA. So why are you looking for genetic influences on an environmental measure? But the answer is that none of our measures in education or psychology measure the environment out there independent of the organism. All of our measures of environment, think of what we measure, you know, the way parents treat children, you know, that could, you know, developmental psychologists have talked about the direction of effects for 40 years. You know, are the parents causing those correlations or are they reflecting differences among the children? But what about stress, life events, social support? Is that the environment independent of us? You know, no. It has to do with our interaction with those environments, and genetics can enter at the level of the individual. I used to say, well, I can't even think of any measure of the environment that's independent of people. And I used to say, well, like the weather, we don't have anything to do with the weather. But it's pointed out to me, of course we do. I mean, some people who are seasonally affective disordered go to climates, you know, where the sun shines, unlike England. Okay. Right, so now I'm going to begin talking about these three topics going beyond nature and nurture. But I thought I'd just stop for a second to check with Kurt that I'm on the right track here. And Howard.
Great.
That's
perfect.
Okay? Yeah. All right. Because I don't really know, you know, how much background you have if I'm talking at the right level. Okay. So in terms of passive GE correlation, the data that exists involve treating environmental measures as dependent measures. And there's probably 30 or 40 studies of that type, looking at most aspects of the family environment. I had a study that went on for 10 years with Mavis Heatherton and David Rees that ended up in a book a year ago that looked at every measure of the family environment we could study, including videotapes of dyadic and triadic interactions, everything we could look at. And it's just like behavior. Everything shows some genetic influence. Some things more than others, kids' perceptions of the environment, more than the parents' perceptions. Parents are loath to say they treat the kids differently to begin with, for example. So there's lots of research that says that genetics effects are measures of the environment. And in quantitative genetics, this is assimilated under this construct, genotype-environment correlation. And there are three types that we talk about and that are measured using different designs. The first is passive, in that children receive an environment in which genes and environment are sort of passively correlated. Their parents provide them with genes, and they provide them with the environment. The kid doesn't have much to do with it. Those are the genes and the environment they're receiving. And an example in education involves the big one of family background, for example. I mean, is family background strictly an environmental measure? There's, you know, a lot of evidence suggests it's not. And it could be that family environment could relate to school achievement of children due to passive GE correlation. It wouldn't be, I'll come back to it, but it wouldn't be evocative or active because the kid's genotype is not causing the SES, but it could be passively reflecting a GE correlation of the passive variety. Okay, well, I know that's a bit tough to understand, but it does seem to be the biggest one of the three, so it's probably worth trying to understand a bit. But these two are more interesting. Evocative, you know, if you've ever taught children, you know you can't help but be attuned to strengths that you see in the children and weaknesses. You know, you try to minimize those weaknesses and maximize the strengths. And to the extent there's genetic influence in those strengths and weaknesses, then you're setting up a GE correlation that is in a response to the children. So the children evoke, on the basis of genetic propensities, those experiences. And the third is probably the most important, but very difficult to study, because despite decades of talking about this sort of thing, I'm not aware of the measures that try to get at it. And that is that the environment just doesn't only respond to the children's genetic propensities, but that children actively create environments that foster their genetic propensities. Okay, so that, you know, as I mentioned, musically gifted kids can make an environment that's correlated with their genetic propensity. They can beat on pots and, you know, sing and hum and hang out with other kids who are musically oriented. So I'm very interested in this topic. Our center at the, as Kurt alluded to, in London at the Institute of Psychiatry is called the Social, Genetic, and Developmental Psychiatry Center. And social means environmental. The goal of the center is, in a way, quite simpatico with what you're doing here, and that is to bring together environmental and genetic strategies to study the development of behavioral disorders. And I think this topic of GE correlation is one that hasn't received enough attention, but I think is particularly important, and especially, I believe, when we get to molecular genetics. I wanted to just mention, as I go along, the implications for molecular genetics. And what this means, GE correlation, is that when we find genes, say genes associated with reading disability, I bet those genes are correlated with reading learning environments. And so I hope that doesn't sound crazy to you now, that DNA, a specific gene, can be correlated with a measure of environment. Okay, well, the second topic that I wanted to talk about in terms of nature versus nurture is, its bumper sticker is, the abnormal is normal. And before I go there, I'll just stop a second here to see if there are any points of clarification. We'll save the overall discussion, I think, for the end. But if you're totally befuddled, now's the time to ask. Or, I mean, if you have any other specific questions. Okay, good. So the second topic, the abnormal is normal. The bumper sticker is very short, but I can't think of any way to describe it other than this long sentence. So common learning disabilities are the quantitative extreme of the same genetic and environmental factors responsible for normal variation in learning disabilities. Okay, and that, you may say, what? But the radical way of saying that is there are no common learning disabilities. They're merely the low end of normal variation, that the abnormal is normal. And so what I mean here by there are no common learning disabilities, they're just the extremes of normal variation. And that isn't to denigrate them at all, but it's just to say that we're not looking for unique causes of learning disabilities. It's the same causes that are there throughout the distribution, both genetically and environmentally. Okay, and there's lots of implications that follow from that. But
I have a question about that. still thinking about the surprising finding that the heritability seems to be greater for the learning problems than for psychological issues like depression, and then even for the more purely pure diseases, right? But you wouldn't say this about the diseases, right? I mean, about breast cancer, for example, that it's just a quantitative extreme of the same factors. Because I'm wondering, in other words, are we comparing apples and oranges here?
Well, there's lots of questions embedded in that. Specifically in terms of breast cancer, is breast cancer just the extreme of normal variation? And you say, well, you either have breast cancer or you don't. Do you? No, it's probably quantitative. The vulnerability, I think, and the genetic susceptibility, I bet you, is a quantitative distribution, even for something that you think of dichotomously as breast cancer or not. But that's a very tough case. But when it comes to psychology and cognitive development, I don't think it's nearly so tough. Because what I'm talking about is, with depression, say, you know, are people, no one thinks people are either depressed or not. I mean, people accept that there's an almost continuous distribution. The example I used to use that I thought was harder, autism. And people say, well, gosh, autism is so unusual. Surely that's not part of a normal continuum. But, you know, most of the research now is focused on the spectrum and continuum between autism and the rest of the variation. So I'm talking specifically about the genes, and it's an empirical prediction that if we find genes for reading disability, I predict they're not for reading disability, they're for reading ability. That is, they will have as much of an effect at the high end of the distribution. So you take a kid who's good in reading, if they have those alleles, those forms of a gene, they'll be better at reading than their siblings who don't have those alleles. So the prediction is at least clear that when we have genes, I'm predicting that they're not for reading disability, they're for normal variation in reading. And this is only true, though, and this may be part of what you're getting at, Howard, but for common disorders. So I'm emphasizing common here. In the medical area, where we know a lot more about these things, there are about 5,000 single gene disorders that I'm going to just talk about in a minute here. Those are necessary and sufficient. They're not part of a normal continuum. So, here, I've got these on these next slides, so let me just launch into this. I call this the Oh God model. Because most people learn about genetics in terms of Mendel. Mendel studied single gene disorders in pea plants. The disorder is having wrinkled seeds. And it's a single gene. If you get those genes in your pea plant, you have a wrinkled seed. It doesn't matter what your environment is or your genetics. It's monogenic, completely deterministic. As is in humans, thousands of single gene disorders. Huntington's disease. If you get that dominant gene, you die from Huntington's unless something kills you first. It doesn't matter what your environment is at all. It's completely deterministic and hardwired. Now, that's the way a lot of people think about genetics. And that's why people worry about it. They think about it in this deterministic way. But that single gene disorders are very rare. We're often talking about 1 in 30,000, 1 in 50,000. Teachers won't ever see these. When we talk about disorders, we're talking about common disorders. Now, autism, schizophrenia, those are kind of in the middle, but as more and more people are thinking about them as a continuum, and the incidence of those is going up for autism. So this is the single gene model, the monogenic model. That is, everybody's pretty much the same genetically, except for some rogue genes like this one that causes a particular type of learning disability. Okay, so it's a tricky message. There are 200, in the last, there's a survey done in genetics a couple months ago, 242 single gene disorders that have mental retardation as one of their symptoms. And the average incidence of those is something like 1 in 50,000. They're very rare. They're often very severe. But they don't have much to do with, even though they're dramatic for the kids with those genetic disorders, they don't have much to do with learning disability in the population. The way people think about it now is not in terms of lots of these single genes, but rather in terms of a quantitative model for common disorders. That there are many genes, and I'm just showing a red gene and a yellow gene here, that are associated with quantitative variation. And we're interested in the low end of that distribution, rightfully so. I mean, because that's sort of the business end of it in terms of education. But it's nothing, it's an arbitrary line in that the association works across the distribution. Whether you have a yellow or a red or both of those genes, it makes you more likely to have a low score. But neither the red nor the yellow gene are necessary. Here's a yellow and red, or sufficient. Here are guys who are above the line without either a yellow or a red for the disorder. So quantitative, this is called quantitative trait locus models. Even though you're talking about disorders, it's called quantitative trait locus because if there are multiple genes that affect a trait, you almost have to predict a quantitative distribution. So when we talk about molecular genetics, this makes the study of the molecular genetics much more difficult because most everybody accepts now that the genetic influence on learning disabilities involves many, many genes, and that means that they each have very, very small effects. So that's the nub of the problem with molecular genetics that we'll talk about a bit later. Okay, so I'll stop and discuss this with you, Howard, in just after this slide, to say that it's not either or. You know, almost wherever you get into these heated arguments, you know, it's usually because both of them have some validity. For common disorders, I believe that what we're going to find are these rare single-gene disorders that often affect just one family. You've heard about FOXP2 in language. That only affects the KE family. No one else has been found with that mutation. We studied 300 kids who meet criteria for language disability. Not one of them had that mutation. It's an extremely rare mutation, probably only in that one family. Doesn't make it uninteresting. It may tell us about basic biological processes, but it doesn't have to do with the high heritability that we find for language impairment. So I think there will be these single gene disorders, but that the vast majority of the genetic influence on common disorders involves QTLs. Okay, did that at least touch on the questions you're raising, or should we save it?
Little bit starkly, there are probably fewer false positives and false negatives in breast cancer than there is in reading problems. It's a much fuzzier kind of diagnosis. And for that reason, I wouldn't have the same degree of confidence in the assessments vis-a-vis a math problem than I would vis-a-vis breast cancer. Now, you could argue that's not correct, that in fact they're equally fuzzy. I suppose that's an empirical question, too.
I take the general point you're making. I think breast cancer was a bad example because, you know, it's a hot topic now how bad the diagnosis of breast cancer is. But except at the very severe levels, and again, for reading, probably at the very severe level, we're more comfortable with our diagnosis. But, there's so much to say about that. Maybe we should save most of it for discussion. I did just want to say, though, that diagnoses are bad, I don't believe in diagnoses. I think these things are quantitative, and that we get ourselves in a box when we're trying to say, where is that dividing line? And we have all these DSM meetings about, is it three of those and four of those or not? Well, I see it all as a quantitative distribution. You know, heart attacks is another example along the lines of breast cancer. Isn't that an either-or event? Well, not completely, but largely. And so you might say, well, okay, there's an example of something that is qualitative, but it's not. You know, it's the susceptibility is continuous, and the causal factors are continuous, like serum cholesterol levels are related continuously to risk for heart problems. Okay, yes?
So are you saying that even though the threshold line is...
Say breast cancer, well, the threshold line is clearly delineated by nature, and with learning disabilities, we decide, okay, at this point it's a learning disability, at this point it's not. It's still a genetic continuum. The only difference is whether we determine where the line is or whether nature does.
Well, I agree with you in the last part that we're determining where that cutoff is here. But what was the first part? Where did you say we're doing it with nature?
Well, in terms of breast cancer, if someone develops a lump, then at that point that was determined by nature. At that point they have the disease, and at the other point they don't, or is it so at that point the line is more determined by nature?
Well, I think it's a question of the phenotypic description here. And if you've got a lump, I mean, you know, when it's clear that it's breast cancer, okay, then it's pretty clear. But that's what we were saying, like reading disability. There's a lot less difficulty with a kid who has very severe reading problems to say this kid has a reading problem. But even with breast cancer, you know, lots of lumps, sometimes difficult to say. And, you know, cancer is a normal growth process. So, in a way, I mean, that was the most exciting thing about genetics. You know, all the stuff on the war on cancer and what made the biggest advance was basic biology, understanding that what cancer is growth, normal growth processes gone wrong. So they don't go wrong all of a sudden one day. You know, it is a gradual process by which they go wrong. And, you know, even if you have some of those mutations, they're not automatically cancerous. It takes hits from the environment as well. So I think when we get in there and learn more about it and realize there are not these three genes, there are hundreds of genes that are involved in that breast cancer susceptibility, as well as hits from the environment, are necessary for that, I think we'll realize that it's much more continuous than we thought. Okay. In terms of molecular genetics, this is, as I said, the implication of this is that when we find genes for reading disability, I predict that they won't be for reading disability, but rather for the continuum. And I do find parents of children with problems appreciate this approach. Now, some people say, oh, well, you let them off the hook. Well, that irritates me very much, like with schizophrenia, you hear that. Gosh, you know, the stuff on genetics is bad because, you know, of course, parents of schizophrenics like it because it lets them off the hook. Well, I said, you know, damn right. They don't belong on that hook, you know, from Freud and on down, where they say, you know, all the problems that you have are due to the way your mother treated you in the first few years of life. You know, this mother blaming, I think, shows how genetics doesn't always wear the black hat and environment the white hat. You know, I mean, I don't think genetics could ever do as much damage as has been done by environmentalism and the failure to recognize genetic influences. So parents, I think, are very happy with this perspective because it means it's not as if their kid's abnormal. It's not as if, you know, here's all the other nice kids in the world and here's their child over here with this disorder, which is the way diagnoses tend to paint it because we're all concerned about this magical diagnosis. And I don't think it's true. I think it's quantitative. That's stated a bit provocatively, but I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about. Okay, the third and last topic. These are, you know, picking from the genetic research in the behavioral sciences, some topics that I think have the most bearing on education and cognitive development. So this third topic, I have a psych bulletin paper that will come out on this called Generalist Genes. And the idea is that, you know, we talk about specific language impairments, specific reading disability. The point here is that most of the genetic action is general, not specific. The genes that affect math disability are largely the genes that affect reading disability. This involves this is quite a different topic from what we've been talking about. It involves multivariate genetic analysis that studies the covariance between things like reading and math rather than the variance of each one taken separately. So the question we're asking here, okay, there are genes that affect math ability, there are genes that affect reading disability. Are these different sets of genes? Could be. And to some extent they are, but to the larger extent, the genes that affect one learning disability are the same genes that affect the other. And that most of the covariance, comorbidity between disorders is genetically mediated, and most of the differences are environmentally mediated. So the reason one kid has math disability and not reading disability is more likely to have an environmental answer, whereas what's in common when most children have both is genetic. So this has a lot of implications, and it's not widely known, so I thought I would end on this as my first topic. Everyone's pretty much aware, I believe, of the phenotypic, that is, the observed overlap between most of our learning disabilities. Now, we talk about specific reading disability and specific language impairment, but if you don't impose some arbitrary criterion, like you only can have this and not anything else, you'll find that there's quite a bit of comorbidity. Now people would say, right, that's why we're studying specific ability. Okay, you know, one could do that. But when you do that, what I'm saying is you're mostly studying an environmental disorder, whereas if you study kids with reading problems, and why discriminate against those that have other problems? You know, what we know is they have trouble reading, so we want to do something about it. We don't say, oh, you've got some other problems too, so goodbye. And when we just study these problems together, we find that there is comorbidity. But when we do these multivariate genetic analyses where you look at the covariance, what's in common between disorders, rather than each disorder separately, you find that the genetic story is interesting, that most of the genetic effects are in common. Like 80% of the genetic effects overlap between different types of disabilities. Like the ones that have been studied most are reading and language, and increasingly math. So what that suggests is that when we find genes for reading disability, we've also found genes for math disability. The way to interpret this is that if you found a gene for reading disability, I'm predicting you got about an 80% chance that that gene's going to be associated with math disability and language disability. This is the genetic overlap. The environmental overlap is much less. So that's why I'm saying what makes these disorders different is largely environmental. What overlaps is largely genetic, which suggests that perhaps the same neurological processes are involved to the extent that there's genetic influence on these traits. So I know that's a lot to absorb, but it has implications for me especially because of molecular genetics. Most people would want to look for specialist genes. You know, reductionism in science would have you say that if you're going to try and study the brain or genetic origins of a problem, you want to get down to a very specific aspect of the problem. Because, why? Because people assume, well, if it's more specific, it's going to have a simpler cause. In terms of genetics, molecular geneticists think, if you get closer to the brain, you're going to get down to simple single gene disorders. It's going to be simple genetically. And I don't think any of that's true, necessarily. And what I believe is the case is that if you study specific disabilities and try to do a molecular genetic study, you're going to make it very difficult. Because what I've been saying is that what the genetic action is in the comorbidity. It's in what's in common. So if you study reading disability and you were truly able to study it independently of everything else, then what you've got isn't very genetic, because the genetic action is what's in common. So conversely, if you want to study the genes because you want to study the neuroprocesses involved with those genetic effects, you should focus on what's in general, not what's specific. And this really goes against the tide of, or the general reductionistic philosophy that most biologists have. Can you see that? Okay, so those were the three topics that, three findings from genetic research with implications for education. The nature of nurture, genetic influences on environmental measures. The abnormal is normal. Common disorders are the quantitative extreme of normal variation. And thirdly, generalist genes. The genetic action is what's in common rather than what's specific. Okay, so for the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes or so, I'd like to talk about molecular genetics and what's happening there. Because I think quantitative genetics is very important still in terms of charting the course for molecular genetics, like that last example I gave you. Rather than studying specific learning disabilities, studying the genetics of what's in common among disabilities would be a better strategy. So quantitative genetics charts the course for molecular genetics. But there's some very big things happening in molecular genetics that I just wanted you to be aware of. And the main one's this, that the molecular genetics that's been done so far is excellent and powerful for finding single gene effects. That's how it all started. It was a race to see who could be the first one to find a gene for these different disorders. So the approaches were not very powerful. They would pick up very big effects, like a single gene effect, like this. But then when people started applying them to psychology and psychiatry, they took those same techniques and haven't come up with much at all. And I think the answer is that we're, based on this QTL model, that we're certainly not looking for one gene. You know, some of the studies out there would only find a gene if it's one gene that accounts for 100% of the genetic variants. Then 5 years ago, molecular geneticists started saying, well, okay, maybe there's other genes, but really there's one probably big gene and then a bunch of tiny genes that we'll never find. You know, on what basis? You know, there's no evidence to support that. For common disorders, you know, for the single gene disorders, it's not even science anymore to find the gene. It's clerical work. I mean, the methods are all there. You know, you get it done at a company in a few days. Once you get the samples, it's no problem finding a gene. You will absolutely find it if it's a single gene. But the problem is we're dealing with common disorders that have multiple genes, and we're looking for many of these needles in the haystack. And nobody knows how big a big one is, but what we do know is the small one could be very, very small. It could be idiosyncratic to an individual. If most of the genetic effects are of that latter sort, we're sunk. But what we're hoping for is that there are some genes of modest effect size. And what's modest? Well, that's subject to debate. I think we have to have the power to detect QTLs. That is, these QTLs are just genes. Actually, they're DNA. Most people don't think most effects are in genes anymore. That's another story. So QTLs is a better word because it's agnostic as to whether you're talking about a gene, which is the coding region of DNA, which is only 2% of those 3.5 billion nucleotide bases of DNA. So 98% of the genome does not involve genes. It involves other things, some of which more and more people recognize as important. So I think we need to have the power to detect effects that account for 1% of the variants. 100% was a single gene, right? And then people went to, you know, effects maybe 50%. Most of the studies that are done cannot detect an effect that accounts for less than 10% of the variants. In the last 5 years, people have gotten studies that can detect effects of, say, 5% of the variants. But to go from 5% to 2%, you know, we're not talking about doubling sample sizes. It's something like it's a factor of 10. You know, we need monster studies to detect small effects. And I've come in the last year, based on our research, to recognize that we're going to be awfully lucky if we find any QTLs that account for 1%. I think we have to detect 0.1%. And that's what our studies are designed to do. What's good about designing a study that detects 0.1% of the variants is you pick up the big effects too, whereas it doesn't work the other way around. If you have a study that only picks up big effects and there aren't any big effects, then you don't detect anything. So to break this 1% QTL barrier, we need very large samples. For 1%, we need 500, say, reading disabled kids and 500 controls. Now, to do a systematic search using association, you need more than 100,000 DNA markers. The ones that mostly are used are called single nucleotide polymorphisms. There are millions of these in the genome. This means of the 3.5 billion nucleotide bases, you look at one of those and you say, ah, people differ on that one base. That's a single nucleotide polymorphism, SNP, S-M-P. And there are millions of those that have been found, and some people say you need 300,000, 200,000, but you need at least 100,000. Everybody would agree. Now, all this, if there are any molecular types here, I'll just say, all this heat about how many genes you need, it's all relative, because if you're thinking QTLs, this is a holdover from monogenic work. How big a study do you need to detect this gene that accounts, you know, it's monogenic, it accounts for 100% of the variants? Well, there we know how big an effect size we're looking for, a huge effect size. Here, we don't know how big the effects are. What if they're very, very, very small? You'll never detect them. It doesn't matter if you have a million SNPs or if you have samples of a million. You'll never detect them because they're so small. So my point is, it's all relative here. And I'm happy to go with 100,000 SNPs in fairly large samples of, say, 1,000 or so, to pick off the biggest of the small effects. Not all of them. You know, I don't think the issue is can you exclude every possible DNA related to something like reading disability, because it's a mug's game, because of what I just said. You know, it could be so small you never detect it. The problem with this, 100,000 individuals say 100,000 SNPs is cost. If you just did it the usual way, even at 10p a SNP, that's all it costs to genotype a SNP. Genotype is a lot cheaper than a lot of the research you guys do, especially with videotapes, for example. But if you do it this traditional way, that's very cheap, it still is 1,000 times 100,000, and that's coming up to $20 million if at 10p a SNP. So that doesn't work so well. But what does work are microarrays, and these are, you can go out and buy one of these machines if you have $100,000. And this is what's going to take over the field. It is already. It's mostly used for expression work. But what a chip is, as it's called, microarray is about the size of a postage stamp, and on that postage stamp you can measure 100,000 SNPs. And because it's so micro, it does it with very little DNA and it does it very quickly. So in a couple of hours you can genotype an individual for 100,000 SNPs on a chip. So the chips, however, cost, for this big one that does 100,000, costs $1,000. So that's kind of expensive, but not so expensive. It's going to be used in medical clinical work now because, you know, there are thousands of single gene disorders, as I said. They're very rare. They're often recessive. If you're going to mate, you're going to get married, you're going to mate with somebody, you've got to you worry about carriers. They're so rare because these genes are, these disorders are, say, 1 in 30,000. Chances of you being a carrier, rare. Chances of your spouse also being a carrier, very rare. So it's not worth doing it. But if you have a chip that can do all of these for in a couple of hours for $1,000, you'll do it. Because if you know that you and your spouse are carriers, you know that you have a 25% risk of your children having that disorder. So it's all cost-benefit. But this is really happening now, and this is all the research we're doing is based on this. So each of those little dots is assessing one DNA variation. So you cut up the genome into tiny little pieces, basically, and you hybridize it to these ligands on this glass plate. And here's one of them. You're measuring 100,000, but each of those 100,000 are measured by millions of probes. To give you an idea of the miniaturization involved on that. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So that's why they're called chips, because, you know, the best analogy is like silicon chips. You're talking about, you know, micro at that sort of level. So it's really phenomenal. Each of those polymorphisms is measured by 40 different probes, where matches and mismatches, you move it along the genome so you're not getting anything specific. I mean, it's truly mind-boggling. And it's mostly used for expression work. That's what most of the work has been done, where you can have tens of thousands of genes and look at reading-disabled kids versus controls to ask which genes are being expressed differently in these groups. It was first used to diagnose different types of disorders, like different types of cancers, to see which genes are being activated by that cancer, differentially expressed for people with one form of cancer versus another form of cancer. Well, that's expression. That's measuring RNA transcripts. Genotyping chips measure DNA polymorphisms, not RNA quantitative expression, but SNPs are biallelic polymorphisms. You have one of two alleles, so you can have AA, BB, or AB. You can only have those three genotypes. And that's what these chips do. Now, because they cost 1,000 each, and you can only use them once, if you have 1,000 subjects, you get the 100,000 SNPs, but it costs $1 million. But it's well within the boundaries of researchers, especially at Harvard, I would say. And people are doing this. They really, there's the study of autism. You know, it's gotten... But you see, what I'll end up showing you is that what's good about DNA is it's going to bring education in with all the life sciences to the extent we're talking about the genetics, biology, and brain. And that's what I want to see, is education in psychology be a full-fledged member of the life sciences. Okay, so that's a microarray. I could talk about that forever. But at $1 million in England, we're not going to do it either, Kurt. So even in medicine. So what we've been working on the last 8 years or so is something called DNA pooling. I'll just mention it briefly. But the problem with 1,000 subjects is if you have 500 reading disabled kids and 500 controls, that's 1,000 subjects, that's a lot of genotyping. But could you, we put all the DNA, a tiny bit, like a few nanograms of DNA of each subject into one test tube. And we mush it up and we genotype that test tube of pooled DNA. Because that's what we're trying to do, is to estimate the relative frequency of one group versus another. So we've done a lot of work on that, and the point then is that you end up with 2 rather than 1,000 genotypes. Can you see that? So that was very cool, and we've done that now for a while, and we do replicate groups, you know, because we want to replicate this sort of work. So DNA pooling, I think, is great, and it's really starting to take off. We published our first paper in 98, as did some other people, and last count, there were something like 500 publications using DNA pooling. So it's really happening. But What I'm incredibly excited about is what we've done in the last 6 months, and that is, you see the advantage of microarrays, 100,000 SNPs. You see the advantage of pooling, but pooling would still cost over $500,000 if you've got 100,000 SNPs. Because it's not just 10p that's a startup cost. Now, this sounds like trivial, right? But $70 for a startup, you know, if you do one SNP. Well, that's no big deal, right? But times 100,000 is a big deal. Okay, so that's the problem. So here is the coolest thing on Earth. Putting pools on microarrays. So that this study now costs $2,000 because you only have two pools, two chips. And it works, you know. So we've got a number of studies coming out on this. So I think this is the best thing since sliced bread. Because you can do these studies very quickly and cheaply, and it keeps it mom and pop, you know, which is the great thing about genetics. The real success has been that anybody can do it. You need a thermocycler. I mean, you don't need, I mean, these sequencing machines, people don't have their own very much. It's a shared resource, because if it does this in a couple of hours, I mean, you don't need to have your own, because you're only going to use it a few times a year, probably. So you get the idea then, right, that, you know, that this is very cool. And we've got several papers coming out on mild mental impairment where we do use this approach to find genes. We do the pooling, then we get genes that replicate across a lot of different studies, and then we do individual genotyping on them on samples of 10,000 individuals to make sure that we have the power to pick up any small effect so that we can say, is it just working at the low end, or is it working throughout the distribution? Is it working for boys as well as girls? Is it related to mild mental impairment? Is it related to reading disability and math disability? You know, you can ask a whole lot of questions then with tremendous power to do that. And that's all from that twin study I mentioned to you. And so we've just begun now reading disability and math disability. We expect to have them done in a couple of months, because the 100K machine that does 100,000 SNPs just came out in June. So we've just got it now up and running. And we have managed to get a first study done already using the 100K. We've done a number of studies on the previous version, which is a 10K chip. But 10K is demonstration. 100,000 is a genome scan. So I think it's really exciting times. And this isn't the only thing that's happening, obviously, but it's what I'm doing. And it gives you a sense of, you know, it just is a mind-boggling area. You know, every time you turn around, there's something totally new. So the excitement there is one reason why education and cognitive development should be jumping on it, just the way they're jumping on neuro. Because a lot of the neuro people, the leaders in the field, are definitely jumping on genetics. So might as well, you know, head them off at the pass. Okay, and in terms of educational implications, whether you, I don't know if people will like this or not, but I do believe that it's us behavioralists working at the level of the whole organism, the person in context. It's at the organismic level that will make the biggest advances. It's not just when you find a gene, you do molecular biology. I think we'll have major advances in terms of DNA-based diagnoses. There's some evidence for that in ADHD, for example, that some of those dopamine genes that are associated with hyperactivity predict methylphenidate response. Now, you know, it's like all this stuff, the samples aren't large enough to be definitive, but if it's true, one reason you'd want to do it as a clinician is you'd want to say, well, this kid isn't likely to profit from Ritalin. So I think DNA will be routinely collected. You know, there's a field version of this big machine that I'm talking to you about. I think it will become routine. You don't need blood. You can collect it just using a Q-tip. That's what we do, is we do it through the post. We get on these 30,000 kids that we're studying. You get enough DNA just from rubbing the inside of your mouth for thousands of these DNA markers, especially when you're doing pooling and SNPs. More importantly, DNA will have impact on our treatments, I think, you know, as I mentioned with methylphenidate. But the thing I'm most excited about, and the only thing I think that DNA can uniquely do, is serve as an early warning system. Because DNA is causal. There's nothing that happens in the environment that changes the DNA structure other than mutations. I'm not talking about expression, which isn't genetic. It's just a phenotype. But the DNA variation that we're talking about is not changed by the way your parents treat you or the environments that you experience. It's causal. Now, it's not deterministic because there are many genes involved. But brain isn't causal. You know, if you find something lighting up in neuroimaging, that doesn't mean it causes the behavior we're studying. It could very well reflect it. If you don't read much, your brain's going to be different. So By starting with DNA, I think it's going to shed light on the brain and the way the brain works by starting with something that's solidly causal and understanding how those genes work themselves out in the brain to affect behavior. Okay, and just one more minute here to say that in terms of research, those were clinical implications, but in terms of research, this is going to be important as we move from finding genes to using genes. The buzz phrase in molecular is functional genomics, which is basically, I think, biology. It's how genes work, but it's when you're talking about the whole genome and many genes. But functional genomics is viewed in a bottom-up way, where you start with the cell. Whereas I've been pushing the phrase behavioral genomics. We have a book, an edited book that came out, Behavioral Genetics in the Post-Genomic Era, and the answer, if that's a question, if we put a question mark at the end of that, is behavioral genomics. And here's what I mean by it, that molecular biology has hijacked the phrase functional genomics to mean you go back to molecular. You go back to a cell and you study molecules as they interact in a cell, and then eventually you work your way up to the brain. You know, good luck, and people will do that. But what we've got to argue for is different levels of analysis, and that the behavioral level of analysis is just as legitimate and I think much more likely to pay off in terms of diagnosis, treatment, and prevention, because we're dealing with the whole organism as the organism develops, interacts with, and correlates with the environment. So I think a behavioral genomic level of analysis, once we've got genes and use them rather than just trying to find genes, is going to show that these top-down levels are equally important as these bottom-up levels, and that ultimately we're all going to meet in the brain. Okay, thank you. Okay, so now we've got time for questions, discussion. Yeah.
Are impacting the behavior. Have there been any studies that have looked at how these genes that we've found, that are 80% genetic in learning disorders, have we found any correlative fMRI studies or for the math and learning disabilities that are exhibited?
Well, the thing is, we don't have any genes that are associated with reading disability yet. There are linkages, there are sections of chromosomes that replicate, but nobody's pinpointed a gene yet that is associated with common reading disability.
Okay, so the 80% was from twin studies.
From heritability, it's from twin studies. But your point's a good one, and that's one of the things you'd want to do. If you get those genes, you'd want to understand how they work in the brain. Because I think by starting at the genetic level, even though I'm not a reductionist generally, for that little tiny window on what's going on, it will help us trace the effect from genes to behavior through the brain.
Right, and because as you said, you never know if it's the brain affecting behavior or behavior affecting the brain. With that information, behavior could be trained in children or specially augmented for them to learn.
Exactly right. No, just so. That's right. And it's also a reason why you can do a mouse model of learning disability and reading disability.
Also.
Because if you find the gene and you want to understand how it works, mice have prefrontal cortex, let alone everything, you know, more primitive than that. So you can trace that gene out in the mouse brain up to a point, at least. You don't need a behavioral model at that level. You need a brain model, and the mouse brain model isn't bad up to a point, at least. And the only reason I mention that is, you know, it's unbelievable the sorts of things you can do in neuro with mice. And especially, mouse is the main organism for genetics, so it's a great interface. And there is, in fact, a £25 million project in England that's an interdisciplinary study called Genes to Cognition. That's all focused on mice, but going from genes to gene expression to proteomics, which is the idea of one step beyond expression, genes are actually working. Gene products, proteins, are actually working in constellations, and they're involved in the protein in secondary structure and folding. So there's so much to be learned about the function of proteins as they interact with other proteins, and that's called protein omics. You know, someone ought to have a moratorium on the use of omics, but one of them that's really stuck is proteomics, which is protein genomics. It's one step up from gene expression, which is the actual transcription of DNA that gets transcribed and then translated into products, but it's at that point that proteomics takes over. So Very good. Thanks. We'll wait for this to get back to you, all right? So this is what I meant, though, about psychology and education being brought into the life sciences by means of DNA, because DNA really is a common denominator for all of the life sciences. And I do find that the basic biology people are increasingly interested in our sorts of stuff, because they know, you know, deep down that it's really important.
Hi, thank you for coming to speak to us. I was wondering if the reason that we, or that you haven't identified a reading disability gene, I was wondering if that's related to the lack of consensus about how to define a reading disability, because there are so many subtypes.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, did everyone hear that? The question is, you know, maybe part of the difficulty has been in definition and diagnosis, which is the point Howard brought up before. And, you know, could be. And, you know, it might be that if we have more specific measures, you know, you might, you know, you can do these studies now. If it only cost a couple grand to do it, maybe, you know, we can do it every which way. But the point of what I was saying is that I think it's more general, you know, and it's not more specific. Now, it's always, it sounds weird. I'm not saying, well, it doesn't matter how you measure these things. It does. But, dare I say it, you know kids have trouble reading. I mean, you know, you can talk about component processes being very difficult, but we have to keep our eye on the fact that this is a behavioral problem. And the behavior is how well they read. Now, you could say, well, maybe that's because of different reasons. Well, maybe, maybe not. But the end point here is our problem is some kids have trouble reading. And when they have trouble reading, it's usually kind of general reading problems. It isn't often that they have one very specific reading problem and everything else is hunky-dory. I mean, it's generally a general process. Now, I don't have to hang my hat on that, though, because I think we can study these things every which way if we want. And it's at least empirical, because if we find a gene related to, say, general reading problems, we can say, is it more related to this component? Is it more phonological? Is it this or is it that? Now, I predict it's going to have very general and diffuse effects. But, you know, I could be wrong. And it could be that we'll have better luck, as you're suggesting, if we focus in on some more specific aspect of reading. But the quantitative genetic results that I'm following suggest that there's some merit in going the other way, and that is looking generally, not just generally across reading, but generally across learning disabilities.
What definition do you use for your 500 cases of reading disabled children?
Yeah. The question is, what criterion do we use? And we're using a composite based on this Tower reading test, in which is just a 3-minute test we administer over the phone, but it is the single most predictive test of general reading problems, even though it's just a word recognition problem. Now, this is at 7. It might be different at 9. We're doing studies at 9 now, where we move from, you know, learning to read to reading to learn, you know, all of that sort of thing. But we use that test plus this Key Stage 1 national curriculum end-of-year score for the kids. So it's a very general measure of reading processes and problems. And, you know, I know that doesn't appeal to a lot of people. You can see, coming from my perspective, where it's very interesting for me to have such a general measure. It'll come out in the wash. We either find genes or we don't. And when we do find them, we'll see. Are they related to one aspect or to the other? Yes.
Professor, I was looking on your website. I saw that Sheila Walker, one of your PhD students, is looking at quantitative genetic analyses of school achievement. I wonder if you could just speak a little about that research and perhaps look a little at the ethical issues that might arise from such research.
Okay. Well, that research is the research I just described. I mean, reading is one aspect of school achievement. So we're measuring the major components that are studied in the English national curriculum, which is reading, English, and math, and science. So that's what we're studying, using teacher ratings. We're now using web-based tests. You know, 85% of kids in England have daily access to the web. So we're now using the web to get at much more sophisticated sorts of cognitive processes related to school achievement. So that's what we are doing, using tests as well as teacher ratings of things that could be broadly defined as school achievement, but coming from a cognitive background, you know, I see them as all interrelated. So now, what specifically did you have in mind about the ethics of, say, studying reading?
Well, I was just wondering if you were getting any ethical heat on these matters of these sorts of measurements, of conducting these sorts of measurements.
Are you questioning the measures, like using a teacher assessment at the end of the year, or...
Not so much. No, I'm more concerned about how these things translate into a wider community, into a lay community, how these things get picked up and used. And
what do you mean by these things?
Findings.
The measures?
Yeah, the measures. And the, yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't find...
Stigmatization question?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, kids are stigmatized in school, perhaps. I mean, you know, if they're put in, you know, if they do any streaming and kids are put in the special education classes, I don't have anything to do with that. I'm taking the score that they get at the end of the year from those teachers, and I'm trying to study it to get at the ideology of it. So I don't think I'm perturbing the system. I mean, there's nothing I'm doing that isn't out there already in terms of measuring the kids. Are you specifically worried about if we find genetic influence, is that going to be misused?
Yes.
It's a general thing that comes up in education communities all the time. It's one of the reasons education communities have often resisted bringing biology into the picture, because a lot of people believe that biology leads to stigmatizing kids. It's biological, you know, it's like fixed forever because they have a certain gene. And I think your arguments are much more sophisticated than that and lead away from that kind of simple viewpoint, but it's something we face all the time in the education community.
Well, I mean, I just don't get into the stigmatization issue, you know, labeling so much. I mean, if this is an all-powerful fact, why don't we cure everybody and just don't, you know, say, you're not reading disabled, you're not schizophrenic. Labeling, you know, labeling so powerful. You know, so I get a little tired of that because where's the evidence? But nonetheless, there are certainly important issues here. And if genetics contributes to that, it's because people misunderstand, you know. What I'm trying to say is single gene disorders are deterministic, but if there are multiple genes involved, we're only talking about propensities, risk factors, just like environmental risk factors. They're not deterministic. They're not hardwired. So, and even when they are, sometimes the best way of doing something about a disorder is to find out it's genetic. The best example is phenylketonuria, you know, which is 1% of the institutionalized mentally retarded population. By finding out it's a single gene, so it's deterministic, what was the result? You know, we didn't sterilize those kids. We didn't do eugenics. We found out that the way that gene worked had to do with metabolism of phenylalanine. And phenylalanine, if it's not metabolized, builds up in the brain and causes severe damage to the developing brain. So with that knowledge, people said, hey, well, what if we cut down on phenylalanine in the diet? And that's been the way it's been treated since the 1950s. And it involves genetic testing. You know, and that could be labeling, right? Because, you know, this kid has a single gene disorder. But every country in the world does it because of this cost-benefit analysis. The cost is minimal, pricking the heel, the Guthrie test in the first few days of life. If the kid comes up positive, you do your best to make sure phenylalanine is reduced. And so it's all cost-benefit, you know, and I think that's what's going to happen here if we find genes for reading disability. Well, what if it turns out that... Sorry, I have to move over here because I can't see you when I do this light. What if one of the genes we find, even if it accounts for 1% of the variants, say, what if its effect has to do with lower than required levels of trace elements in the uterus during pregnancy? Well, from a cost-benefit point of view, we do genetic screening for it because even though the benefit is small, the cost is incredibly small because you'd want mothers, you know, during pregnancy, it's very hard to monitor these trace elements. So it'd be good to do something to make sure that they get those trace elements. You're unlikely to be doing harm. And if you're doing just a little bit of good, I bet most mothers would do it. They'd vote with their feet to do it. But, you know, on the other hand, until we find out about the etiology of these disorders, it's hard to say. And I would imagine most interventions aren't going to be simple like that. They're not going to be biological. I think that most genetic interventions are not going to, they're certainly not going to be genetic engineering. I mean, everybody understands that. Even with single gene disorders like cystic fibrosis, it's been incredibly difficult. No one's really done a successful gene transfer experiments yet. So it's very difficult to do with a single gene disorder. So if there are multiple genes involved, I think it's not, you know, even on the screen. So I don't think we're going to do genetic engineering. What we're going to do is behavioral engineering. You know, we're going to know that kids have a genetic risk, and we're going to intervene to prevent problems before they occur. And you could say, oh, my God, what about labeling? And I say, you know, I don't, you know, show me that it's important. In contrast to waiting till kids get problems, you know, we're not very good at fixing problems once they occur. Maybe we're better at reading than we are at some things. Obesity, we're not very good at it. Alcoholism, and partly it's because we wait until the problem's so bad that people's worlds fall apart. So even if you could, you know, sew up someone's stomach and stop them from eating, their lives have still, you know, deteriorated, their social relationships and everything else. And you can't put those bits of Humpty Dumpty back together again. So I think prevention is the important thing. And we're just going to have to fight the fight on labeling and stigmatization. And I think people will vote with their feet.
So should we kind of expect that schools or policies will demand a sort of genetic ID before getting into a school or getting into a program? And that would be a good thing because it will actually help people design the right intervention or prevention.
Well, I think it's going to happen in your doctor's office sooner than people think.
Yeah.
And it'll be cost-benefit in terms of education. I mean, I think if we do find that certain treatments for kids depend on knowing about genetic risk, it will happen. And here's where it's happened first, the area of dementia. Do you know that there's only one known risk factor for dementia, and that's a gene. It's a QTL. It's a big one. It accounts for 15% of the vulnerability to late-onset depression, which is the common one. You hear about genes for Alzheimer's. Those are single-gene disorders for early onset, very rare, less than 1% or so. So the common dementia shows genetic influence, but only one QTL has been found so far in every study that's looked at it because it's a big QTL. It accounts for 15%, not 100%. So this is the apolipoprotein E. It involved lipoprotein, which is cholesterol transport. And you say, what? Because, you know, it doesn't go in the brain. But it's found that it does go in the brain. And so this risk factor is like a fourfold increased risk for late-onset depression, which in medical terms is huge. Now, schizophrenia, you know, or some of these other things, we're talking about much bigger effects than that. But now that that gene has been so well proven to be associated with dementia, and it's the only known risk factor, you can't do a study on dementia where you don't genotype your subjects. Even if you're studying diet, depression, you've got to say whatever you're studying, does it interact with this known genetic risk factor? So that area, which was mostly done by sociologists before it went into the medical area because of APOE, as it's called, was totally environmental in its orientation. And I think that's great because they still are. But they're epidemiologists largely. But they're incorporating DNA as just another risk indicator, just like environmental risk indicators. Nothing different, except that you can measure something quite precisely, which is a nice change. You see what I mean? So I think that's going to happen in other areas. And so once that starts happening in a bigger and bigger way, it'll come into medicine, and I think it will come into schools, especially if we can do something about it. APOE doesn't come into medicine. You don't get it if you go to your doctor later in life because there's no known intervention. And so cost-benefit-wise, it's not worth the cost because, okay, we tell you you've got the risk and we can't do anything about it. Okay? So I'm not trying to slip out of it. I mean, that's honestly, I think, all we can say at this point. I predict that it'll happen once we have some preventative or at least diagnostic approaches. Does anyone have the microphone? Oh, sorry.
I was just going to ask, is there a particular journal or publication that you could recommend that would go much more in depth? I know because of we have time constraints, but I mean, I'm extremely fascinated, and this is exactly what the direction that I'm going in, and in particular in terms of learning disabilities. Is there a periodical or a publication that you could recommend that would...
Yeah. Unfortunately not. I mean, this stuff is spread out totally across all journals. I mean, there's no journal that begins to have a monopoly on this. I mean, just for background reading, because there isn't anything else around, my textbook called Behavioral Genetics really does try to bring together quantitative and molecular genetics, so it's referenced in those papers. But, you know, it's too bad there isn't something more basic or, you know, one place where this stuff goes. But I think what that reflects is the fact that these ideas, you know, aren't specific to cognitive development or education or psychology. This stuff, everything I've talked about, is just as relevant to studying medical disorders and neuro sorts of development. So that's why I think the stuff is spread out over all journals. Yeah, she's got the mic. You can get it next.
My older son has reading issues, and he wasn't diagnosed till he was 8 years old. And I would go to the pediatrician every year and ask him if he had a speech and language problem. And he was just seen as, well, that's how boys are. It was more of a gender issue. My area, by the way, is the early diagnosis of learning and attention disorders in boys. But what was very frustrating is that this went on and on and on. And even though I produced a speech test that was given to my younger brother back in 1967, which had the same scores as my son had, and they still wanted to wait. And I'm so in support of what you've talked about, because if the pediatrician had just asked in the first couple of years about my family history, we would have avoided a lot of remedial work that was very hard at 8 and 9.
Hmm.
And so it's the question I guess I have is, just from the communication of this to the public, just even a simple article about early diagnosis and the incidence of genetic history would be so helpful for parents.
Well, thanks. And that's why I was pleased to come here, because I think it's you folks that need to do it. You know, someone from the outside, you know, saying these things doesn't really have much impact. It really matters when people, you know, get into the area themselves. And you don't have to become a geneticist. That's the neat thing about it. You're not going to go out and do gene finding. It's real big-time science, and you need lots of money and big machines to do it. But what you want to do is be positioned to use DNA as it becomes available in your area, which is starting to happen in ADHD. It's going to happen fairly soon, I think, in reading. And it'll happen eventually. And I think it'll happen more now that we recognize we're not looking for one gene of a big effect. What we're going to be looking for, and what we're doing with mental impairment, is getting 5 at least that account for, say, 1.5% of the variants. Okay? And we can use all 5 as a genetic risk indicator. Because it's so cheap, you know, the genotype, 10p, so that costs 50 pence, half a dollar to do this. You know, so no sweat, you just do that. And then you've got, that's just 1.5%. Okay, you get 5 more, maybe you're up to 2% or 3%. It's only, you know, 50% heritable or something, so it's never going to be deterministic. And it's a question of, at what point does it become clinically useful information? At the level of an individual, I don't know if it ever will be diagnostic. I don't think so. But at a public health level, you can have a big effect, you know, on the population by making decisions with this sort of information, raising a host of problems as well. But that's where we're going in this work. At the behavioral genomics level, you can, even though each of these QTLs accounts for a small amount of variance, if you get a bunch of them that accounts for a reasonable amount of variance, you can use them as a genetic risk indicator, just the way we use family environment and SES. SES itself doesn't do anything. It's just a marker for a whole host of other things.
One thing I'm wondering if you could comment on is the incidence of hyperactivity and reading disorders. It's hard to tease out whether the child actually has a decoding or comprehension problem in some cases, or is just not able to attend.
Yeah.
After a certain point in time, I think they can diagnose it initially. Just wondering if you could speak to that and just what you found when you were working with children in terms of environmental, when the child was hyperactive and how that counts.
There's a lot of hyperactivity research at our place, but it's not something I do in particular. Mm-hmm. But we have had a paper come out just in the last few months saying that some of the genetic overlap between hyperactivity and reading disability is mediated genetically. Some of it is. But I think it's a good example of what will happen when we find genes. So if we find genes for reading disability, to what extent are the genes that we find for reading disability the same genes that affect ADHD? And if they are, it suggests that there are common genetic processes in the brain that are causing that overlap. It's also interesting if you find genes that are specific to reading and not affected by ADHD. And yet there's some work suggesting that the two aspects of ADHD are important here, the attentional versus the, you know, hyperactivity. And most of the research is suggesting the link is between the attentional component and the cognitive learning problems. Sorry, who's got the mic? Oh, you've got the mic, yeah.
I'm interested in the slide that was missing about the the correlation of behavioral diseases and genetic inheritance. Could the results be biased by the fact that the twins live together? And have you had access to some studies about twins that have been raised in different places?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that there are problems with the twin method and problems with the adoption method. What's nice is they have different problems and they give the same results. So that's good. The problem with the twin method is the one you're raising. More generally, it's called the equal environments assumption. You're assuming that identical twins and fraternal twins get comparable amount of environments. It's similarity. It's not the problem that they're reared together, because so are fraternal twins. So that's not a problem, because that contributes equally to identical and non-identical twins. The only problem would be is if identical twins are treated more similarly than fraternal twins. And there's been quite a bit of research on that. It seems to be a safe, rough assumption. There are differences, like identical twins in the past tended to be treated, dressed more similarly. But, you know, is that going to relate to their reading disability? Not very likely. And the ones who are dressed more similarly aren't more similar than those who are dressed less similarly. So there's research of that sort. In addition, there is some research on twins reared apart, but there's lots of research on adoption, which is not identical twins reared apart. There are just very few identical twins reared apart. We did a study of 750 pairs in Sweden, because in Sweden, at one point in the early part of the century, 20th century, about 1% of all twins were being separated because of a worldwide epidemic and economic recession in Sweden. Did I say this was in Sweden? So we were able to trace those families. Those kids, of course, were now very old, and so it was a study of gerontological cognitive aging. And in those studies of identical twins reared apart or in adoption studies, the results conform almost exactly to what you expect from the twin results. So if you take that all together, and the fact that behavioral geneticists have been trying to address this issue of the equal environments assumption, you know, it seems like it's a reasonable assumption. But the proof of the pudding, as with all these things, is DNA. You know, when we find genes, you know, we're predicting these are highly heritable characteristics. But that's a good question. But I'll just mention for completeness, the main problem with the adoption method is selective placement. What you're trying to do is to use a natural experiment, a social experiment, I mean, of adoption. By studying, we know things run in families, but both genes and environment run in families. So a family study that shows resemblance, you know, even in what you were talking about, doesn't prove it's genetic. It could be nature or nurture, right? So adoption separates those by taking genetically related people reared in uncorrelated environments. Uncorrelated, not necessarily different, just not correlated. So you take birth parents and they're adopted away children. And those children that are reared in the early in life with the adoptive parents and whom they share that family environment, but they share their genes with their birth parents or their biological parents. So that's a very powerful design to separate genetic and environmental influence. Its main problem, though, is this uncorrelated environment. If children were placed in the correlated environments, then it wouldn't be as good an experiment. That's called selective placement. Now, the evidence is that selective placement isn't a very big deal, especially recently, in the last 50 years, which is the current wave of adoption. And that's because it's thought that it would be bad to tell adoptive parents they're going to get a kid just like them, because they won't. Even if you have your own child, the first law of genetics is like begets like. The second law is like does not beget like. That's the point of sex, you may be surprised to learn, that you're 50% similar and 50% different. genetically. So it's better to prepare parents for the adoptive parents for the fact that the kid won't be just like them, number one. But then number two, there aren't that many kids, and it's usually based on the waiting list. And the parents are screened. That isn't selective placement. They're screened at a kind of low level. You just don't want, you know, parents with bad psychopathology adopting children. But that's all the way it used to be when there were a lot of babies for adoption. But since the 1970s and 80s, as contraception and abortion have become more common, there aren't so many of these children placed from adoption agencies, and it's mostly gray market babies, and you know, nobody knows much what's happening there. See, she's had her hand up a lot. Oh, does someone else have the mic? Yes.
Okay,
and then we'll do you, all right? Yeah, and she's been waiting a long time.
My question was what reading program they use in England, and if you think, if you studied a different reading program, whether or not you get the same QTL or perhaps would find a different variation.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. You know, if the national curriculum were successful and all kids were getting exactly the same education, that would increase genetic differences. Do you see that? People don't realize educational opportunity, if it were actually effective, which is very hard to make it true, it would increase the heritability because you'd be taking away an environmental source of variation and making it the same. You're making it a constant for everybody. So the more specific point you're making is that if a different educational program was used, you might get different results. And these are all empirical questions. You know, and that's the sort of thing I want to study. So if it's something to do with the national curriculum in England, first thing you'd want to do is look in America, you know, and see with all these different, you know, educational programs with devolved educational authorities, you know, does that make a difference? So good question. Thanks. Oh, yes.
Has there been a finding in the advantages of being a twin in terms of cognitive development or?
No, there's no advantage. And in the first few years of life, there's a disadvantage in terms of language. Often thought because you've got someone else babbling at the same time you are, whereas normally you have someone who's about a year and a half older on average than you. But by seven, by the early school years, there's hardly any difference between twins. And that language is the only area that shows that effect. There's no difference in terms of psychopathology between twins and we call them singletons, non-twins. So at least that aspect of the twin method is okay. It does seem to generalize to non-twin populations. Okay, we'll come back to you. Someone have the mic? Oh, yes, you can have the mic. Good.
Could all of this be applied in malformations that are not inherited, that are as a result of some external influences, I don't know, like gene malformation as a result of radiation maybe or something like that? Is this applicable in that kind of disorders that might occur?
Well, see, those would be environmental events, wouldn't they?
Yep.
So radiation causes a somatic mutation or a mutation in the brain. If it's not transmitted, if it doesn't make identical twins similar, then it won't show up as genetic in these studies, right? Okay, so the genetic definition is very narrow. And I think what you're getting at is the environmental definition is extremely broad. More technically, in quantitative genetics, environment is non-genetic. So you have a narrow definition of genetics and everything else is called environment. And that can involve radiation, illnesses, prenatal events. It's much broader than we usually think about the environment. Thank you.
Okay, I was wondering, it's been suggested that disorders like dyslexia also have other coexistent linked traits, such as perhaps an enhanced musical ability or creativity. What do you think current genetic research can tell us about things besides perhaps math ability that people with dyslexia or disabilities also express?
Yeah. Well, that's easy to answer because the answer is nothing. I mean, there is no research along those lines. But that's a great opportunity for research, both at the quantitative genetic level and at the molecular genetic level. I mean, it's a good question. You know, your point was that reading disabled kids might be higher in creativity, for example. And the closest we've got at our place, Frankie Happy is part of our group, and she studies autism, and her focus is on the positive aspects of autism in the sense of, you know, this focus on detail, you know, the central coherence idea. And so she studies cognitive tasks in which autistic kids do better than normals because they can ignore the general aspects of a stimulus and focus in on details, ignoring the whole and focusing on the part. So, you know, I hope I didn't give the impression everything's done. I mean, because, you know, it's sort of the first tiny bit of research in this area, and there's tremendous amounts of work to be done. During the introduction, Kurt mentioned the environment, and, you know, the GE correlation is something I'm very interested in, and we focused on those issues in terms of the family environment. And I've just got a grant from NICHD to take those same concepts and study the school environment. The extent to which kids are, you know, that the effectiveness of an environment is dependent on the kid's genotype, whether the kids are selecting and modifying environments, you know, GE correlation in the schools. So, and that's just beginning.
I could comment a bit on that. This is one of the areas where the folklore and the anecdotes are very, very divorced from the empirical evidence. There are all sorts of folklore that it's good to be left-handed, you know, it's good to have depression in your family, and because we can all think of people who managed to do very great things despite those handicaps. But when people have looked at these things empirically, they by and large find that at best it's a wash. Namely, you know, they're no worse than other things, but it's not like you have the what's called a pathology of giftedness. The autistic study, if it pans out, would be an interesting one, though perhaps not an unexpected one, since that's almost the definition
of
autism.
It is, yes. No good question. I think the main point I was making there is that there's so much to do along those lines, taking a quantitative genetic approach. The problem with quantitative genetics is you need a large study. So if any of you are thinking, well, you know, maybe I could get 20 pairs of identical and 20 pairs of non-identical twins, it's not worth doing. Heritability would have to be greater than 100% to have 80% power to detect it. You know what I mean? And so the problem is you will interpret it. You'll get results saying, oh, this is heritable, that's not so heritable. You need four times the power to say that. You know, detecting heritability has a power that requires 50 pairs of MZs and 50 pairs of DZs if it's 50% heritability. If you want to say this trait is more heritable than that trait, you need about four times as many twins. So it's very tough to do this work. Now, you can do family work. You can study siblings very often, and that's kind of a foot in the door, but you still need quite large samples. But molecular genetics is going to change all that. Because if you have genes, you can incorporate them in any study you're doing. So that I think people who have large, unique samples who aren't collecting DNA now are making a big mistake. Because when genes are found, you just go back to all the data you've collected. Because that's where the excitement's going to come in functional genomics, understanding how these genes work. What's the earliest developmental aspects of this? Does it only pop up at reading? Is it there earlier with language and cognition? This is all part of behavioral genomics. Is it related to just this aspect of reading or that aspect? Is it also related to math disability, for example? So that's the multivariate issue. And then the big one is genotype environment interaction and correlation. Does that genetic propensity interact with, that is it conditional upon, some aspect of the environment in terms of its effect on development? That's interaction. And the correlation is, to what extent does that genetic risk actually correlate with experience? So those are categories of questions that can be asked once we find genes, and that's where you guys will come in, I think. Probably not at the quantitative genetic level or at the level of finding genes, which unfortunately is still where we are, and it's still promissory for me to say we're getting closer. But I know there are several conferences, like the big one. You asked about where this stuff happens. The psychiatric genetics meeting is in Dublin this weekend, which I'm going to miss because of this, but there are several talks there in the abstracts that are called Praise the Lord, Genes at Last. Because in schizophrenia, there really are a couple now that most people agree. Because they agree that they're small effects. You know, that's the difference. They're not big effects. And then if you cut out the studies that didn't have the power to detect the small effect, you're finding, you know, pretty good confirmation of it.